I've told my story before, and Harry heard it over there, and he said, "Are you going to bring pictures?" Because the last time I brought a bunch of paintings, it seemed like, you know, I could tell the story better by showing the paintings. So I didn't bring the paintings. I brought a sketchbook here that I've written my autobiography in. Yes, in the introduction, Tim was talking about how alcoholics have found God, and so we were passing the church up there with the tongues in the front of it on Briarwood and Jewish Old Road. And so I said, "Yeah, resurrection. That'd be an appropriate theme for my talk." Recently they've had a lot of stories on television about Charles Dickens. His stories, David Copperfield and Little Dorrit and Oliver Twist. And to me, I like these stories. It's sort of like my story, you know, somebody that was born in pretty good circumstances and then bad things happened and they went down to terrible circumstances of homelessness and destitution, and then all of a sudden good fortune came back to them and they assumed their proper place. And so, like, you know, I'm 80, I'm going to be 81 May 11th, I've served for 26 years. And my day today was very different from my drinking days. I got up maybe about 7:30, and we took the car to the garage, and I got a car, my buddy and I here, and then we went to a ceramics class, and then we had the Dorothy Benson Senior Center, and then we had lunch with Miss Dorothy Benson herself. And later on, we went to a water aerobics class, and then I took home and took a nap, and for a little meal, which I'm here, you know. That's a lot of difference from the days when I was drinking, where, you know, I'd be outside at 7-Eleven, you know, waiting to get a six-pack of beer until the liquor store is open, and then I go back to the house and pull the shades down, and that would be the end of that day, you know. It would be, I had a lot of days like that. So I'm going to read this paper first, Alcoholism and Attitude Therapy, by Dr. Bernal Fox, MD, who used to be head of the DeKalb Addiction Center. And I met Dr. Fox in the company of Dr. Charlie Fulton over at the Cherokee Canyon Country Club many years ago, maybe in the 50s or 60s, and I was not sure, didn't think I was an alcoholic at that time, but my husband certainly, I thought he was. And I said, "Doctor, you know, it's somebody who could do anything for a drink." And so, yeah, she said she knew plenty of them like that. So she starts out saying that alcoholism, she thinks of it as a disease, although it's sort of a catch-all phrase, and it may be secondary to a lot of mental illness, underlying emotional disturbance. But she calls it a disease because the person who has it is grossly uncomfortable. It was not functioning in a homeostatic manner, is sick, and is not manifesting willful misbehavior. It is logical that people prefer to be comfortable. then she goes on to describe various alcoholics she's treated. And she says the most baffling group, after discussing the ones with severe mental illness, are the ones that manifest no overt psychiatric conditions. To all intents and purposes, these are people who are so normal as they just didn't drink. And their neurosis is manifest entirely by their alcoholism. They're charming people, usually gracious, very anxious to please. And they'll be that way for several months at a time. Then for no obvious reason, they are on a 1 to 4 week drunk. And that was typical of me at the end of my drinking, going on sprees that would last from a week to a month. When they become sober, they become remorseful, apologetic, and they rapidly rebuild their previous acceptable position, which I had done many times, only to destroy it again. So, she goes on to say that, in her opinion, the alcoholic of this sort has very little sense of personal worth, very little ego strength, and a hell of a lot of anxiety, both ontological and situational. So having an inadequate sense of personal worth, what does it do to that person? He tries very hard to buy love and approval, but he expects more and more. He's constantly frustrated. He always feels a sense of failure. It's never enough. And so then she says rationalization and denial are the major blocks to seeking help. And that the major difficulty people like me have is their lack of faith in themselves and the fact they're capable of living well-adjusted, happy, comfortable lives. Accepting this is a problem and not the manifestation of worthlessness is attitude therapy. So the reason I'm mentioning this is because, I'm going to tell my personal story, how this fits into the picture of how I come up with my alcoholism. I was born, my maiden name is Ann Dobson, May 11, 1928, in Bellevue Hospital in the suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Well, I was the fourth daughter out of four, followed by the only son. So when I finally ended up at the shrink, Dr. Sheldon Cohen, the first thing you want to know about me was my birth order. So I was in a very unfavorable position to get attention because, you know, the girl babies were more or less throwaways by this time. They were really disappointed. And mother and dad were, the mother was 38 and 40 when she had the little boy, who subsequently died, and daddy was in his 40s, and it was the Great Depression. And she had joined the Catholic Church. She had been a Methodist. Daddy was an Episcopalian, but she was converted, didn't practice birth control anymore, and here she popping three babies out when she was, you know. So I don't think mother, she was a wonderful person. She was a very talented musician and a pianist. And I know she did as good as anybody could, but she suffered terribly from depression on her side of the family. And they were very bright people, but there was suicides in that family. But mother did not drink. She would serve a little glass of sherry to the priests when they would come over from across the street in the evening. She said it made her kid me. She didn't drink. I understand daddy had been a drinker and carouser in his younger years. And she would tell a story how he ran his red Panther into a concrete abutment after a poker game and had broken his jaw and had nerve false teeth. So she sort of liked that happened, because apparently he was out quite a bit, you know, carousing around. So he had developed bleeding ulcers by the time I was born, and he couldn't get one. He tried to get a shot of whiskey now at each one of his daughter's wedding, and believe me, it would kick up his ulcer. He'd be sick for months, you know. So I'm bringing out the hereditary factors. It's never mentioned alcoholism in any family conversations, and my daddy talked a lot. And my niece called me up today from Eugene, Oregon, and she's writing family histories and back to, you know, when I was the secretary of George Washington and this and that, and a lot of them are artists and Episcopalian ministers that. Apparently, my grandfather Dobson, I feel, who was the artist, George Heath Dobson Jr., my grandmother had divorced him in the 19th century, and she had three sons, too. And they would tell stories about how he came around with a horse pistol on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and they had to pull the blinds down. And so, you know, after the divorce, this sounds like maybe there was some the grandfather carried those drinking genes. So I think it's not only birth order and nurturing, but I think it's in the DNA in my case too. So anyhow, it was decided that I should be the artist like my grandfather, George Heath Dobson Jr. And after my little brother died, I was about 7 and he was 5. He died of spinal meningitis when the big flood came into Johnstown, PA, in the Pittsburgh area. Well, my mother sort of went into permanent mourning then, and she lived up in the attic of the house, and my older sisters had more or less raised us. But my sister Mary Virginia became Daddy's favorite. And she had an IQ of 175. And she was gorgeous. And she was bad. I mean, she was real bad. Anyhow, I lived in her shadow and formed a codependent relationship with her. She was about a year older than me. And we would do the dishes at night. We had to, you know, there's Jolie, she knew my sister, she can tell you this. It seemed like I didn't even have. I was like one half of a person. She was like the right-hand side of the brain. I was the right-hand side, just a personality. And she was, became a lawyer. She was, could read ledgers and be logical and all. She was the left-hand side. So I lived in her shadow and served her wishes until I was in my 50s, when I began to break loose from her by moving to Albuquerque. So I'm trying to get the drinking history in here. Is it over? So anyhow, yeah, I come from a nice family, and we grew up in this nice two-room mansion. There was no drinking. But then I got in college. Yes, I was a talented artist. Was admitted to Carnegie Mellon University, where I became great buddies with Andy Warhol, Philip Philstein, a lot of the big timers, some of the theater people there. And of course, there were fraternity parties and all these guys had just gone out of World War II in 1946-50. And they were battle-hardened veterans. And so, you know, they knew how to drink a lot of hard liquor, and, you know, they didn't want, I was just out of a Catholic girls' school, Sacred Heart Academy for girls, and didn't date hardly at all, and getting into this environment with these grown-up men, you know, that, geez, they prepare, want to get married on the first date, you know, and then, so, you know, it was just like being catapulted into a more mature level there, but there'd be a lot of drinking there at the fraternity parties, and I had a gorgeous black silk taffy dress with a big bow and a sash coming down, and I can remember how sick of that drinking would make me, and in a fraternity house, I can remember that I was throwing up and that sash got in the toilet, you know, and it all covered with all that nasty stuff, and I'm trying to clean up. Then I was dating this other guy. He was a Mennonite, the Catholic minister, and he was studying to be a gynecologist at the University of Pittsburgh, and he only had a date about every 3 months. And he would be like a wild man, you know. And he tried to get me to drink. And he didn't have a car. We were walking up the hill to my house. He passed his Taylor Alderdice High School, you know. And here I am, growing up in the bushes, and he's trying to make out with me, you know. The same time. The next day, my daddy says, "Oh, that was a nice young man you were out with last night." I don't like him so much, Dad. I'm going to marry a doctor, you know. But, my friends like Andy Warhol and, Philip Pelsey. They all left Pittsburgh and went to New York, you know, to see if they could, you know, do their artistic thing. Of course, some of them were very successful, and some of them we never heard from again. So my daddy said, "Like hell, you were going to New York. You will end up in a charity hospital in 3 months." I don't know how he knew so much about it, but he was sort of like this Charles Dickens people that had been around, you know, as a child. And so I married a southern boy that came south, and he was severely alcoholic from the first drink. He had in service, but he concealed that from me during the dating, and the reason he married me is he had been in the merchant marine in World War II, and he was going to be drafted into the Korean War. So his daddy told him, "Oh, well, why don't you marry that Yankee girl and get her pregnant? That way you won't be drafted, you know." And so he said, daddy said, "Oh, no, you're not going to marry that southern boy." And my mother said, "Don't come back here with your baby." And so I married him anyhow. Sure enough, he was drafted when I was about 6 months pregnant. We went eventually over there. I went over to Frankfurt, Germany, and lived for about a year. But he had a problem too, because his male cousin, Jimmy, he would come on the honeymoon, and he would come over every night to play chess, and he was just always there, you know. And so, when I got a terrible drunk, he wrecked the whole wedding party in a gulch, and he took a brand new car over the side of a hill, and we saw him in New York City. We said, "Well, Jimmy, why is your car awful?" Not. He says, "Oh, well, I had a little trouble leaving the wedding there." And he ran over the golf, and the mud squirted up over the floorboards, the garage space, and everything, all covered with that. It was terrible. I'm so dumb, you know. I've been to this Catholic girls' school. I didn't know anything about what men did, and there were no boys in the family. I was so stupid, my daddy, just out of deference to the women in the household, he never left a toilet seat up. So I didn't even know why a man would leave a toilet seat up at toilet since I'm when I got married, and I kept falling in the toilet. And she said, what's going on here? You know, I wiped the toilet seat up. So, this married after he got out of service, then I guess I was had the alcoholic personality, although I didn't drink alcoholically then at that time, or at least I didn't think so. I did get in trouble with it. And, you know, I immediately became, I couldn't have that painter art anymore, I became a hostess, a social climber. My husband's cousin had married a nice girl, and she knew everybody in Atlanta, and it was all about joining all the symphony groups and the Tallulah Falls and the Raven Gap groups and being in this whirlwind of social activity. And it was like a 20-year cocktail party, but it was. So there's people, you know, you have bullshots, everybody married, and go to a football game, and go on and on to 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And so, I guess I didn't really, there's a lot of violence in that marriage when we're supposed to be drunk or two. But things didn't get really bad for me with the alcoholism until my husband ran his car into a telephone pole on his 40th birthday. And it was on Northside Drive. He'd been out all night long, and so he got all messed up, and it was around Christmas time, and they couldn't get him in a hospital room. Dr. Stambolakis saw him. I used to teach his son, and so they brought him home in a cast, gripping cast. But he didn't take his pain pills. He just drank a lot of liquor, and it got real violent. Every time I'd pass him, he'd kick me with the cast. And we went out New Year's Eve, and he got very violent. Went to a party on the way home, and my sister was in the house at the time, and he ripped off her black brassiere, and she... It was just terrible. He got me down the floor and trying to mess me up. And so I slammed the bedroom door on him, and apparently it broke two of his ribs. So the next morning, he was coughing. And this was in this gorgeous house, you know, off Mount Perrin Road, you know, with a studio with skylights and two fireplaces. And you know, I can't believe the horror stories going on at places that are supposed to be nice, you know. We went to the doctor. He said, well, you have to take me to the doctor, Dr. Stanley. So I put him in the car. We went by the old 7th Street restaurant. I said, aren't you going to have a drink? And he didn't have one. He said, no. And his father was in the doctor's office when I got there. And Dr. Scandalakis came out with the x-rays and said, well, my name was Bowen. And Mrs. Bowen, your husband has two broken ribs that weren't part of the original accident. And so his father says, I'm taking my son home. And he was 40 years old. And I said, well, you know, you deserve to have a homosexual for a son, you know. And a whore for a daughter-in-law. And so I said, give me $1 and we get my car out of the parking lot. I filed for divorce then, although I was a Roman Catholic, because in Georgia they had no law for separation. I had a few rocks, potatoes in the refrigerator, and three children to feed it now. So, I still see, with my buddy here, Hank, a therapist about every 2 weeks. And she says that depression just don't even say depression, say anger. Apparently, I had so much rage over the fact that I had left my family and moved south where I didn't know anybody and hadn't gone to New York to pursue my career and had these three children and they all had been just totally destroyed, you know. I didn't want to shoot him, you know, I wanted to shoot my husband. But the anger turned in on myself. And I made a suicide attempt. And my little boy found me in the bathroom. The neighbor called the ambulance. He's a police car or something. The doctor set me up. And he said, you don't have any right to take your life because you have to live to raise your child. But I still didn't want to live. I was 38. And I decided... my sister came over and I was going through the divorce and she was already alcoholic. She says, well, just drink, you know, that'll help you get through things. And then, you know, I loaded up that liquor and within 2 weeks, you know, I was, she came over and I had to go to a hospital. And so I thought, well, I'd lose custody of the children, but actually, my husband says, well, why don't you let mother raise those children? She knows how to raise children. I says, are you the example? You know, so she actually died of cancer that year. So thank God I lived to raise those children. And I got on my feet after hospitalization and went back. I sold the big house and I bought a small house down in Morningside. And I wouldn't date anybody to drink. I had gone to an AA meeting in Chicago during that period after the divorce. And my sister was a psychotherapist up there. And she took me there and he advised me to go to AA. So anyhow, I went back out and bought a small house. I went to Georgia State and got my teacher certification. It took me 3 years beyond my degree to do it, but I was a good student. And didn't I just in this period, I can't believe that people can do these things. Well, I'm going to say it anyhow, but I married another alcoholic who was also contributing sexually, you know. He played the bagpipes here in town. He was a good pipe. And I'd say, well, John, if you're going to wear a dress here, what am I going to wear? Well, our marriage was terrible. We both went back to drinking, and it was awful. And I had to sell my house, but I got my teaching contract, my first contract. And he did help me with that contract. He went over to the school and played in bagpipes with them. They hired me, yeah. So we were okay as long as we went on camping trips and there was no touching, you know. No touching. I went into a bad depression there at that time. My mother, as I told you, had depression. It's hereditary from her family. And I always thought, well, mother got better after the menopause. And I thought, well, if I can only live long enough to get to the menopause, it should be okay. And I married another drunk, and same results. Except my living conditions kept getting tackier and tackier. It's like in my clothes, you know. I wasn't buying stuff with the desire, riches, the desire, property anymore, you know. And Everything is just, you know, in that downhill slide. And just, as a matter of fact, I met the third one. Well, they got a 3-day drying out over at the church of Kansas Regional Hospital. And he actually made it with me on a pile of dirty laundry there. Just about how bad things had got, you know. And he was taking these antibody pills. And I was still pretty shaky. I had to go back and teach him in some of the wild inner city schools. And I said, well, you come home with me and give me those antibody pills, you know. my grandpa's on antibody, a very unpleasant experience. It's horrible. So all three of my husbands, they just didn't make it. They had all had treatment, AA, and they're all dead. So, you know, it's really amazing that I have survived all of this. And finally, I got to Houston, Texas. I had left the Atlanta Board of Education after having a really bad drinking spree. And my son Edward was living with me, and we lived over at the Martinique Apartments over here because I wanted to come in from teaching school and just come right here instead of, you know, going to bars. So he would go to Allocate, but as usual, I had some men around there. My own boyfriend was 18 years younger than me, and he was getting my son to sell dope to grade school children. So I says, oh no, this can't be happening. And I packed my kid up and I put him in college out in Colorado. And I started doing the geographic, surveying around all over the country. And it's finally settled in Houston, Texas. I had 3 bad relapses there, but I came back here in 1981. That's what I was gone for 3 years, 78 to 81. And I went to the old Dogwood Club. And I had nothing by this time. I had gone through an inheritance. I had, my children wouldn't speak to me. I didn't have any place to live. I had a 65 Oldsmobile. I had a broken lawn chair and a black and white TV in the car. And I went to the old Dogwood Club, and those people were really good to me. And so now from that start, I put together now 26 years, and now I got 2 places to live, and Tiny S clothes, some Chico's to wear, and got a nice boyfriend that doesn't drink, has never hit me in 5 years. He's never hit me. And when you're as old as I was, 54 years old, working your way back from just zero, you know, I did all those recovery jobs. My dad was a rich man. He gave all of his daughters paid up houses so we'd always have a house to live in, but of course we sold them. And he took daddy over to work. My husband said, my wife will never work. But I had been successful in artist in residence with the Atlanta Board of Education, even though I was drinking plenty. I worked on the stage of 40 different schools. I had cabinet presentations of my programs, and so I got a lot out of that. But by the time I was ready to sober up, you know, I could hardly tie my shoes, and I guess I was just completely crazy. And so I would take, you know, little jobs. I made biscuits in a McDonald's restaurant for an entire year. And I liked it. It was good for me. And then I had a job working as a cashier in a gasoline station out on 75 and Powers Ferry. And I worked over at Pace Academy doing their after school program after that, and gradually when I was 61, I had this wonderful job of cleaning the toilets down at the Triangle Club. So I think they had, I quit the job because they were putting in more toilets. toilets than I think. And I used to get, even though I served about 9 years then, I still didn't have a good handle on my emotions or my temper, and I would fight with all down corn, all the corn down there. And I'm an artist, and I wanted the clubhouse with beautiful black box, draperies for it, and curtains and everything, so Chrissy would buy. And he'd come in and mess up the kitchen with his old cooking messes and make these food signs, and then I would fight and fight and fight every day. I'm smoking a lot of cigarettes, and I had a heart attack. So I ended up in intensive care and for 10 days, and that's when I started doing recovery at NAVA. So I came here, and Hoyt Allison agreed to sponsor me. And he said, you'll do all right at NAVA as long as you remember we have no gurus at NAVA. And I remembered that, and I behaved myself. So I've done well sitting in around here. Now, I have had, since I'm 26 years sober, I've had some good things happen. I'm going to wind it up in 5 minutes. 5 minutes to go, you would just say?
Yes,
I teach now art classes to senior citizens with the Lifespan Group. And through this group, they asked me to give a presentation of my paintings and slides and artwork at the Second Boston Baptist Church. And I was honored as a Georgia artist. That's since my recovery. And my sponsor came there and with a big bunch of flowers for me. And a lovely lady named Anonymous, who is a psychiatrist, bought one of my paintings for a lot of money, and I sold some other ones. And so I think the thing that really touched me the most is recently I was doing some watercolor portraits at the Dorothy Benson Senior Center, where I have a very nice picture up there, Toby Smallwood. And I would take him into the cafeteria, and a guy who used to be on the White House staff, a great big tall guy, would say, "Oh, gee, they're good. I like them." And he also had a sailboat at the Allentown Yacht Club. Well, when I was a social climbing lady, I raised my children in this neighborhood where it was all young doctors and their children, and I painted them at that time. And I painted one of them as Courtney West. Her father is an endocrinologist, has a farm up in Milton. And he mentioned this Anne, and I've changed names a lot of times because these marriages, you know, they're painting these portraits. And Herb said, I wonder if that was my old neighbor, Anne Bowen. You know, she painted my daughter back in 1964. And sure enough, we made a connection, and I have a portrait sitting with her daughter, her granddaughter, Tamara. I'm painting her, Beverly's three beautiful granddaughters. They're like 20, 22, and 24. And they are wearing their grandmother's ball gowns that were made, custom made, back in the 50s and the 60s. And that's one portrait. I have changed the dress three times painting it. So the one thing that was painful about becoming an alcoholic and losing everything was I lost all my connection with who I was before I became an alcoholic. And I've become a lost person. I haven't kept up with my alumni associations or anything at Carnegie Mellon, and I've been like ashamed of what happened to me. But now I'm one of that nice condominium out in Sandy Springs, thanks to Mr. Hank here. You know, I always had a gorgeous ballroom grand piano. And I met a guy here, a lawyer, trying to sober up. And he's moving to retirement home. You know, he gave me his grand piano last week. So it really looks elegant, you know, you can imagine. So I just say, you know, hang in there. God is going to give you back every damn thing you lost and more if you can just stay away from that drink one day at a time. That's it.
What is that?
The first time you know. I don't think I can stand for the whole week.
That's the first time I've seen you blush.
Oh, yeah, I think I took you in the ring, John.
Are you
serious, huh?
Something
to see. Oh, I'll keep for you.
We're going to take a brief commercial intermission for the seventh tradition. Every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, donations, support this group and AA its own. And we're going to get Hank the opportunity to give his side of the story.
Hank's an alcoholic.
He's a ladies man. Hey, would you like to say a few words?
Oh, sorry.
Yes or no? Oh, okay. Go on.
Oh, I'll say that for
work. Okay.
I did not meet this man in a bar. I met him. He was a painting buddy of mine. I met at the Dorsey Benson Senior Center. So I think that voted well for the relationship.
Four times a charm.
That was very interesting.
This day and age we're living in gives cause for apprehension. With speed and new invention and things like third dimension, yet we get a trifle weary with Mr. Einstein's theory. So we must get down to earth at times, relax, relieve the tension. And no matter what the progress or what may yet be proved, the simple facts of life are such they cannot be removed. You must remember this: a kiss is still a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, man must have his mate. That no one can deny. Well, it's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. underneath man. Man must have his mate that no one can deny. Well, it's still the same old story of fight for love and glory, a case of do or die.